This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Israel v'amatar lehem kedoshim tihiyu. You shall speak to all the congregation of Israel, and you shall say to them, you shall be holy, you shall be kedoshim. Why? Ki kadosh ani Hashem elokeichem, because I am holy. We've often commented on that strange request that because God is holy, we have to be holy as well. What's it going to do with us? We can't be God. We can't be the Ribono Shel Olam. He's holy. That's fine. God is eternal. We're not eternal. God is spiritual. We're not spiritual. In what way can God expect us to be holy merely because He is holy? Why is that so important to him? The Medrash Tanchuma near the beginning of the parasha says the following: Kadoshim tiyu ki kadoshani. Amar lohem HaKadosh Baruch Hu liYisrael. Hashem said to Israel, Ad sheloi varosi olami, before my world was created, before the time of creation, says God, Hoyu malachei hashoreth mekalsin osi bochem. The angels used to praise me using your name. Umekadshin eshmi bochem, and they used to sanctify my name using you. Vahoyu omrim, they used to say the following before the world was created. Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael min ha'olam ve'ad ha'olam. Blessed be Hashem, who is the God of Yisrael. That was the way they used to sanctify the God. Which is strange. It's a little bit of an inverted sort of blessing. Normally one would think that the blessing would be, blessed be Israel whose God is Hashem. But it isn't that. It's blessed be God who is the God of Israel. So what is Hashem's yichus? Hashem's yichus is that he's the God of Israel. Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael, you lucky Ribono Shel Olam, you fortunate Ribono Shel Olam, you blessed Ribono Shel Olam. You are the God of the Jewish people. That's what's special about you, God. That's what really makes you special. And Hashem is proud of that yichus. He's proud of that praise. But notice, this took place before there were any Jews in the world. This took place before there were any people in the world. That before there was a world, in fact, God was being praised, says the Medrash Tanchuma, as Elokei Yisrael, as the God of the Jewish people. This is an interesting medrash from many points of view. One is, of course, that it destroys those who believe that what makes us a people is our land. We were a people long before we had a land. We were a people before there was a land. We were a people before there was a world. We were a people before there were people. The concept of Yisrael precedes the creation of the entire world. That's the first principle that the medrash says. Kivan Shenivra Odom Arishon, when the first man was created, Omru Malachi Ashores, the angels got very excited and they came to God and they said, Ribono Shel Olam, Zeh She'anu Mekalsin Oschem B'Shmei, is this the one we've been talking about all these years, all this time that we've been praising you as the God of Yisrael? But we didn't know what this Yisrael really was. We didn't know what a Jew looked like. We hadn't seen a Yisrael. Is this Odom Arishon, is this the example of the person we've been praising you and saying you are his God? Amar lehem lo, says God, nope, this is not him. Ganav, this is a ganav. Fine way to talk about Odom Arishon. That's what he says. Shenema, because it says vatochal min ha'etz, she ate from the tree that she had no right to eat from. This is not what I talk about. So although Odom Arishon was so very, very great, although he was formed in God's own hand, although he was the most spiritual of all human beings that have ever existed, although he had a power of perception and grasp far beyond anything else that any other human being has ever had or ever will have, but a Jew he wasn't, a Yisrael he wasn't. Why? Because there was imperfection. There was one element, there was a middle, there was one element of imperfection. And that disqualifies him from being Yisrael, from being this special being that Hashem called Yisrael. Bonah, 10 generations later, angels are still waiting to see what a Jew looks like. Omru lo zehu, and Noach comes along and they say, ah, Ribono Shel Olam, is this him? Is this the Jew? Omru lehem zeh, says Hashem, this one, shikur, he's a shikur. What kind of, you think he's the Jew? Fine way to speak about Noach. But what does it mean? As great as Noach was, and he was an exceptionally great man, he was worth being saved when everybody else was being destroyed. He was worth refounding the whole of humanity from. So he was a man of enormous value and substantial greatness. Yet there's an imperfection, there's a flaw in his character. Shikur, he got drunk once in his life. But that was enough to disqualify him from being a Jew. He's not a Yisrael. Only my Rishon is not a Yisrael. He did one thing wrong in his life, and that disqualifies him from being a Yisrael. Noach did one thing wrong in his life. He had a little bit much, too much to drink. That disqualifies him from being that Jew. Omad Avrom. Comes Avrom. Omru Lefonov Zehu. Comes Avrom Avinu. Finally, a man who in the midst of a sea of idolatry, through his own perceptions and understandings, comes to the understanding of monotheism. And monotheism doesn't just mean a belief in one God. Monotheism means much more than that. Monotheism means a belief in one value system. Monotheism believes is a belief in one method of judgment. Is this the man? Amar, and he said to them, Ze Gehu. No, this is a convert, he's not the genuine article. She yotzum imenu yishmur. So you say, okay, but converts can become fully Jewish. Yeah, but you see, he didn't become fully Jewish, because Yishmael was descended from him. If he were a proper Yisrael, there would be no imperfection at all. And the fact is that there was some degree of imperfection, proved by the fact that Yishmael is produced from him. Yishmael would not have been produced if there was no imperfection. Omad Yitzchok. Comes Yitzchok. The man who gives his life for the Ribbono Shel Olam, who lies on the altar in the belief that he's going to be killed. Omru Lefonov, they said to him, Zehu, is this him? Omar Lein says, God, no, this is still not the Yisrael. There is a flaw even in the character of Yitzchok. As great as Yitzchok is, there is a flaw in his character. Oyev hu l'soni. He loves somebody that I despise. His own son, Esav. He loves Esav, and God says, and I despise Esav. So there's a flaw in his character. He's not the Yisrael that I'm talking about. Kevan shebo Yaakov, when Yaakov came, Omru lefonov Zehu. Maybe this is the one. Omar lehen hein. Sashem, yes, you're right. This is the Yisrael. All these millennia that you've been praising me as God of Yisrael, this is the man that embodies that concept of what a Yisrael is. Yaakov Avinu. Although he's not the first Jew, he is the first Yisrael. V'chein hu omer, and that's why it says, the angel tells Yaakov, lo yikore shimcho, Yaakov, your name will no longer be called Yaakov, ki im Yisrael yeh shimcho. You will be a Yisrael. It was at that time that Hashem sanctified the Jewish people to His name. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeYisrael, and Hashem said to Yisrael, Hoil v'nikdashtim lishmi ad sheloi barosi ha'ilom. Since you were sanctified to my name even before the world was created, Heyu kadoshim k'shem sha'ani kadosh. You shall be holy in the same way that I am holy. Because it would be no yichus for me to be called, to be praised as God of Israel, if you aren't holy. What's the big yichus of God of Israel, God of anybody? But if you are holy, then it's yichus for me. Then when the angels say, Boruch Elokei Yisrael, blessed be the God of Israel, then that means something. It has value to me, it has meaning to me. So the extent to which my praise is worthwhile depends on you, says Hashem. If you will be holy people, if you will be Kadoshim, then I will take pride in being the God of Israel. So to say, the self-esteem of the Ribbono Shel Olam, God's very self-esteem is in our hands. His job is, his function, his status is God of Israel. What that job means depends on us. If that's something to be proud of or not to be proud of, depends on us. The more we build ourselves into a nation of Yisrael, into a nation that stands for that which Yaakov stood for, the more we build ourselves into a nation of Kedusha, the more the Ribbono Shel Olam takes pride in being the God of Israel. And the more he functions as the God of Israel, the more directly he handles the job as God of Israel. He doesn't hide away from it. He doesn't get embarrassed when people say he's the God of Israel, provided we act with Kedusha. So the method, the means of getting God to be, so to say, more active in his leadership of Bnei Yisrael is by being an Am Kodesh, by being a holy nation. And that's what it means. Daber el kol adas Bnei Yisrael. Speak to every member of the community of Israel. And that means every member today, not only every member that lived at that time, that means every member of the community of Israel that exists today and that will exist in the future, that has ever existed, that will exist. And what is it that we need to be told? What is it that every individual member of the Jewish community needs to be told? Kadoshim tiyu, you have an obligation to reach a level of sanctity. And what kind of sanctity? Ki kodosh ani Hashem lekechem, the same sanctity that Hashem has. It is possible for us to reach a level of sanctity that is the same class as the sanctity of Hashem. The Midrash says, not in the same quantity as Hashem has got. Yochel kamoni, you might think that I've got to be as holy as, you know. We can't be as holy as Hashem, but we can be holy in the same way that Hashem is holy. It is possible for the Jew to achieve sanctity in the same way that the non-Jew, that in the same way that the Ribbono Shel Olam achieved sanctity, or is holy. I'm going to come and pull up some chairs. Now, what is our picture of what the sanctity means? Looking around at your faces, I can see that you're not terribly motivated to try this out. I can see that you're busy saying to yourselves, yeah, very nice, we can be holy, let somebody else do it. I'll support them, I'll give money to them, but let somebody else be holy. I'm quite happy living nicely in Johannesburg, and it's quite okay. I don't need to be holy like the Ribbono Shel Olam. What does this Kedusha mean? What does it mean to be holy like the Ribbono Shel Olam? If we use non-Jewish perceptions of Kedusha, we would come to the conclusion that Kedusha is a function of separateness, of a life of denial, and so on, a sort of a cloistered sort of life. And that perception is in fact reinforced by the Ramban. And the Ramban says that this statement is one of the most important and central statements of the entire Torah. And it's interesting that we should have so central a statement in this sense, in this parasha, Kedoshim tiyu, you shall be holy, and in the same parasha we should also have the principle which has been accepted universally as the most fundamental factor of ethics and morality, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So we have these two things, the most central mitzvahs, both in man-God relationships and in interpersonal relationships, as Bichat Siegel pointed out this morning in Shul, and they seem to be intermingled, as he said correctly, that you can't quite see the dividing line between them, but the Pesedra seems to oscillate between the man-God mitzvahs and the man-man mitzvahs. You don't, there's no clear boundary and definition. But it's interesting that the two pillars of these areas of mitzvahs are both in this Sedra. And the Ramban says it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that you must speak in a nice way. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah that when you sit at the table and you eat, you shouldn't make a noise when you eat. You shouldn't chew with your mouth open. It doesn't say these things. Where do we know them from? It doesn't say that you should dress nicely. It doesn't say all these things. Where do we know them from? It says the Ramban from here, Kedoshim tiyu. That means being holy. What does being holy mean? Being holy doesn't mean that you do the kind of things that people look at you and say, ah, ashloch. Or they eat with you at the table and they say, yach. That's not Kedusha. So this is a blanket commandment that covers millions of areas of human refinement and nobility. This is an obligation to be noble. This is an obligation to be refined. This is an obligation to be special. That's what Kedoshim tiyu means. And the essence of it, he says, what that got to do with sanctity and with Kedusha, he says the word Kedusha means perushim, it means to separate yourself from anything unnecessary that you use in the world, only what you really need. So So that seems to reinforce, in a sense, Lahavdil, that the non-Jewish approach to sanctity as being something separate from the world, something outside of the world, something distanced from the world, taking only as much as you need, eating only what you need, using only what you need. That seems to be the picture that the Ramban paints as well. But Rav Shimon Shkop asks, in his introduction to the Shaira Yosher, if that's what Kedusha means, then what has it got to do with God? You shall be holy the same as I am holy? What does that mean? When I eat at the table, I don't make a noise. I dress nicely. I don't use from the world more than I really need. What's it going to do? If how can Kedusha, how can the word sanctity mean separation from luxuries and unnecessary things? What has that then got to do with God's Kedusha, which we're meant to be emulating? It's not to create a new type of Kedusha, a human type of sanctity. That's not the obligation here. The obligation is to emulate God's sanctity. And how can you talk about God's sanctity as revolving around things like not eating too much chocolate? What's that going to do with sanctity? Explains Rav Shimon Shkop that the essence of Kedusha, of emulating God, is that everything that one does has to be for a higher purpose. And that higher purpose is the community. That in every single thing that a person does, he needs to be making a contribution. That's Kedusha. There's nothing that Hashem does for himself, ever. God never has and never will do anything for himself. Whatever God does is for the good of others. And therefore, says Rav Shimon Shkop, the definition of Kedusha is that everything a human being does at any stage of his life, every single action that he does, is designed for the betterment of other people, of the community, of humanity in general, of a wider community, of a family, of another individual, something. That whatever a human being does, he's doing for the betterment of others. And therefore, says the Rav Shimon Shkop, this is very brilliant, because he now defines what luxuries mean. What are the luxuries that the Ramban says we're not meant to indulge in? Says the Ramban, if a person has devoted his life to a bigger cause, then even the things he does for himself are going to benefit others. If he takes a holiday, that will benefit others, because he'll come back refreshed and vital and able to make a contribution. If he looks after his health, that will benefit others. If he takes a bit of relaxation, if he escapes for a couple of hours and takes his mind off things, that's benefiting others. So whatever he does, if his life is dedicated to benefiting other people, then even the things that he does for himself are inherently for the benefit of other people, unless they're unnecessary. Then it's no longer for the benefit of other people. I was doing something interesting at home. Every Pesach they clean my sforim in the study. My wife takes Pesach very seriously, and she makes sure that every sefer is clean. The trouble is she doesn't do it all herself, and I'm very very happy and relieved that she doesn't. She gets the maids to help, and the maids have the capacity of turning every sefer back upside down. Everyone, they don't even sometimes get it right. They get them all wrong. And also, I've tried also. I know they can't read Hebrew, but I've tried all sorts of ways of showing them how to tell which is the top of the book and which is the bottom of the book. I suggested that they just take it out, clean it, and put it right back again without turning it upside down. Nothing has ever helped. Everything gets turned upside down. So then for months and months after Pesach, takes me a year until the next Pesach, slowly I start turning them the right way around again. And then why does it take a whole year? Because as I take a sefer out to turn it upside down again, I open it up. And once I've opened it up, I stand on the ladder there with the book open, and half an hour later, I realize that I've still only turned only one book upside down. So I put the book back and carry on the next day. And one of the books that I turned upside down the other day was an English book, actually, and it was written by Rabbi Norman Lamb. And I just opened it up, and on the page I was looking, he makes a very nice point. He says, there's nothing wrong in the Torah with having fun sometimes. What's wrong is when the whole culture becomes a fun culture. And this was written in the United States probably 20, 30 years ago. And that's what he was worried about. And he writes about it there, where the whole culture is revolving around having fun and having pleasure. Not as an escape from the serious responsibilities of normal life, but where that becomes life itself, where the whole of life has to be fun. When one's having fun in order to relax, in order to unwind, to re-establish one's vitality, that's fine, if it's kosher fun. that where one's having more fun than one needs to have, what is that doing for other people? When one is having more relaxation than one needs, another book I was turning up to, also an English book, I don't know why they're all English books this week, defined a lazy person. Lovely definition. A lazy person is a person who takes a rest before he gets tired. Now, he takes a rest in case he'll be tired later. That's a lazy person. A person that gets on when he can't anymore, he takes a rest. But the people who stack up there, they invest in their rest so that they won't get tired later on. That's the lazy person. To take your rest because you're tired, that's good. That gives you the strength and the ability to carry on afterwards. And other people will benefit from that. But to take a rest when you're not tired, what does anybody else gain from that apart from you? What does anybody else benefit from the fact that you're resting if you don't need that rest? What is anybody else benefiting from the fact that you're eating if you don't need that food? What is anybody else benefiting from if you're taking a holiday and you don't really need that holiday? That's the Meitzoro, says the Shimon Shkop, that the Ramban means. How do you define whether something is excess or not? It's excess if nobody else is going to get any benefit from it other than you. And we are not permitted, in terms of this injunction, we are not permitted to benefit from the world in a way where nobody else gets the benefit too. We need to be productive so that we take from the world and we use that as raw material to give out much more than we've taken in. A person takes something in from the world, whether it's something material or whether it's leisure or whatever it is. He takes something in from the world and he gives back tenfold. But if he's not giving back, he has no right to take in the first place. And that, says Reb Shimon Shkop, is Kedusha. So it comes out that Kedusha, if one wants to really take it to its extreme and understand it properly, an accurate translation of Kedusha would then be, of the concept of Kedusha, would be productivity. Being productive, being creative. Ensuring that everything that one does is designed to produce something for the benefit of humanity. Whether it's one human being or other, or many human beings, that everything that one does is productive, that one takes from the world in order to contribute to the world. One doesn't take from the world just to keep it oneself. That's what Kedusha means. And if one understands that that's what Kedusha means, then the task, the challenge of becoming holy becomes a bit more attractive to us. It's not a question of locking ourselves away in some kind of monastery and just thinking of God all day. That's not what Jewish Kedusha means. Jewish Kedusha means exactly the opposite. Getting involved in the world in such a way that everything that one is doing at all times is for the benefit of other people. Totally different perspective. The area of the greatest struggle in the question of whether or not one is doing something for oneself or for others is in the area of money. That's where it's hardest. Well, other things, one can find ways to convince oneself that one's doing it for others and so on. But the real challenge of, am I really doing this for myself? Or am I doing this for the benefit of others? Am I amassing wealth for myself? Or am I doing it, am I working for the benefit of others? Am I being productive? Am I being creative? What is the essence of what I'm working for? The area of greatest conflict is in the area where we earn our livings. Where we need to be able to feel there too, two things. Firstly, we need to feel that our work is being productive, that our work is being contributive. And secondly, that the money we earn from that work is going to be used for the benefit of mankind. That doesn't mean one has to give it all to charity. We're only allowed to give a maximum of 20% to charity. It's true that once you've given 20% to charity and you've given the government their share, there's not very much left. But that's not the Hashem's fault that the government takes so much. The intention was 10 to 20% goes to charity. What about the other 80 to 90% that we allow to use for ourselves? But in what way to use for ourselves? In a way that makes us more potent, that makes us more able to contribute, more able to be productive again, more able to do things for people. That's what we need to do. Everything that we do has to be in that area. And in money it's hardest, because money is one of the more selfish things that we're involved in. At what point did Yaakov become Yisrael? He became Yisrael, you remember the story, when he was going to meet Esav, and he'd arranged everything, he divided his camp into three, he'd prepared massive gifts for Esav, he'd prepared for battle with Esav. He didn't know which way this was going to go, this confrontation. So he prepared for diplomacy with gifts, he prepared for battle with an army, and he prepared himself with tefillah. He prayed to God that it should go well. Then he crosses the Yabok River, and he gets the whole family across, remembers that he's left a few odds and ends behind. A few little, a little kettle and a little pot and a little pan, nothing worth very much. And he crosses back over the river to go and fetch what he's left behind. And there he confronts an angel, Sorei Shel Esav, Esav's angel. And he struggles and battles with him until the morning. What is that battle? And why at that point? The Klei Yochro says it's at that point because he shows a weakness at that point. He goes back to fetch a little, few little odds and ends. Is money that important to you? That you'll risk your life to go back in the night time all on your own to the other side of the river to fetch a few little odds and ends? Is that how important money is to you? Now the answer could be yes, money is important to me because money is my vehicle. We've discussed that before in the shiur. That money is my vehicle of reciprocating. Money is my vehicle of investing. Money is my vehicle of chesed. Money is my vehicle of tzedakah. Money is my vehicle of making myself a contributor in society. Of course it's important to me. And I earned it honestly. I know how hard it is to earn it. I'm not going to throw it out, even if it's just a few little odds and ends. That has value, and I work jolly hard for those odds and ends. I'm not just going to leave them. That could be the one approach, which is quite kosher. But it could be a touch deep down in the subconscious of that's mine, and I'm not going to leave it for somebody else. What is he going back for? Is he going back to increase his potential for contributiveness? Or is he going back to ensure that nobody else gets what's his? And that's the battle that takes place with the angel of Esav. Because if Yaakov stands for Kedusha, for sanctity, and sanctity means contributiveness, then Esav stands for the opposite, and that means self-centeredness. That's what Esav stands for. Esav stands for pleasure. Esav stands for doing it all. Everything must serve my needs. Everything must serve my ends. And Yaakov and Esav, the twin brothers, spiritually battle it out that night on the other side of the Yabok River. And then after the fight, the angel says, Shalcheni, Esav's angel says, let me go. Vayomer, and Yaakov says, Lo yashalechecho ki im berachtoni, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And then he tells Yaakov that his name is no longer Yaakov, it's now Esav, it's now Yisrael. Why is it Yisrael? What does the word Yisrael mean? He says, Ki soriso im elokim v'im anoshim v'atucho. For you have battled, you have wrestled with God and with man, and you've been successful. What does it mean he's wrestled with God and with man? So Unkelus and the Targum Yonason give us two different views. The Targum Yonason says, Isravravt im malacha yod Hashem. You have battled with an angel of God. That's what it means. You've battled with God himself, so to say. I am an angel of God. It's true I'm the angel of Esav. It's true I'm the destructive angel, but I'm God's messenger. And I come with the power of God, and you've overcome me. You've beaten me in the battle. And with human beings you've battled and you've won. Unkel is translated a little different, and he says, Arei rav at kodom Hashem ve'im guvrayo. You have battled before God and with people. Not that you've battled God. You've battled before God. And who's the object of the battle? It's all very well saying you battled before God, but who were you fighting? According to the Targum Yonason, you were fighting God. You were fighting this angel, who was God himself. Fine. But according to the Targum Unkelus, you were fighting before God. God is not the object of your struggle. So who were you struggling with? So according to Unkelus, we must say you were struggling with yourself. Within yourself the struggle was taking place. So there are two views. The view of Targum Yonason is that Yaakov struggled with an angel of God, with a spiritual force, external to himself. And the view of Unkelus is that he struggled with a spiritual force within himself. And we can synthesize those two views. He was struggling in both cases with a Yetzer Hara. He was struggling in both cases with that part of man that seeks to satisfy his own needs, his own desires, his own satisfaction. That's the Yetzer Hara. And he was struggling with that as a godly force. Where does that need come from? Who created within us the desire to satisfy our own needs? God created with that within us. That's not something we made. That God created. That's part of human nature. But even though God created it, we need to struggle with it. Because Kedusha means that everything we do is for the contributiveness of others. And inside us, we have a part of us that strives to satisfy our own needs. That's an absolute conflict within us. One part that says, I must look after my own needs, otherwise I'll die. I'm number one. And the other part that says within us, everything I do must be for the good of humanity. There's nothing I'm entitled to do which is only for my own good. Sure, I can benefit too. But everything I do has to be for the good of humanity. Those two forces that are both strong and powerful within us are forces with which we have to struggle. And that's the struggle that took place between Yaakov and the Sorei Shel Esav. My going back to fetch that little bit of odds and ends, that few rands worth of property, what's motivating me? Am I really being motivated by a desire to be productive and contributive? Or deep down is part of my motivation because I resent something of mine going to somebody else and I want it back? What is it within me? And finally, Vatuchal, the angel says, you've won. Now you can be Yisroel. Now you can be called that being which is the model being that God designed before He created the world. That being that God was praised by His angels with the statement, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Blessed are you, God, because you're the God, not of ordinary people. You're the God of Yisrael. And what is a Yisrael? This is the first time in the history of the world that the angels are able to see a Yisrael in action. Yaakov is a Yisrael, a man who is able to overcome the forces within himself to be selfish, to be self-centered, and to be able to be satisfied that every thought, every conscious and subconscious thought, every instinct and every part of him is dedicated to the good of the klal, to the good of humanity and not to his own good. That's a Yisrael. That's what a Jew is. Different picture to what we normally have of the Jew. We sometimes think of the Jew as being very insular, being very involved with his own little world. But in the past several weeks, the theme in all my shiurim has been, get involved in bigger things. Stop being Klein Kepler. Stop thinking small. Start thinking big. And that is the role of the Jew, and that is the function of the Jew. What can I do for humanity? What can I do for the world? What can I do for society? What can I do for the community? Not what can I do for myself. And that drive, the drive for Kedusha, is as natural in the human being as is the drive for self-satisfaction. They are both opposite drives, equally natural, both created by God. It's interesting, there's a psychologist by the name of Sheehy or Sheehy who's written two very important books. One is called Passages and one is called Pathfinders. And I've mentioned them before in the Vesa Medrash, but the one thing that she discovers in Pathfinders is she's trying to work out what is the secret of people who are cheerful. What is it? That's quite interesting. I told the editor of the Saturday Star before last week's Motzei Shabbos Shiur what I was going to be talking about. And he said, are you going to inspire people with a sense of optimism? So I said, yes, generally it will be an honest appraisal, but the general feeling will be one of optimism. He says, do you think people will come? He said to me, so I said, well, it's interesting. I originally phrased the title as, is there life after Hani's death? Then I changed it and thought, no, I know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say there is life after Hani's death. So why fool people? Tell them what I'm going to say. If you don't want to hear that, don't come. So I phrased the title positively. And yes, I said, I think people will come. So he said to me, well, then I'll tell you what, I'll try the same. We've just put up the cost of the Saturday Star. And it's well known, two things are well known. Number one is that good news doesn't sell newspapers. And that number two, once you put up the cost of a newspaper, you go take a dip in circulation for a couple of weeks. Then you start building up again. Those are two rules that are understood and accepted throughout the world of journalism and nobody disputes them. He says, we've just put up the cost, so I'm expecting a dip. And I said, I'll try the same. I'll run a front page of good news. Let's see what happens. So you might remember last Saturday's Star. Gold price going up, everything's going to be wonderful, jobs, everything's just fantastic. So I met with him this week and I said, Lou, how did it go? He said, record sales. I said, same here. And I said to him, I thought that the article was a bit over the top. I thought it was a little bit exaggerated. He said, but we exaggerate the bad news when it happens. Why shouldn't we exaggerate the good news when it happens? So I thought, okay, but that was it. He said, and in that we disproved two axioms of journalism. The one is that good news doesn't sell newspapers, and the other is that when you put up the price that you take a dip in sales. We showed that they can both be wrong. Sometimes people want to hear nice things too. Some people want to hear good news too. This drive for kedusha, for being able to do something for the klal, very, very important. Let's take it a step further. In the same seder, we're told, love your neighbor as yourself. And the Ramban, again, says that's impossible. How can you love your neighbor as yourself? It's not realistic. And certainly it's not a realistic instruction. You can't instruct people to love each other. Love is something you either feel or you don't. You can't tell a person you shall love. All you can tell a person is you shall act in certain ways. You can't tell people how they must feel. You can tell people how they must behave. And therefore, says the Ramban, the Torah must be telling us that you must act towards other people the way you would want them to act to you. You must act towards them as if you love them the way you love yourself. That's how it is. Whether you really love them that way or not is irrelevant. What's important is that your behavior towards them is as if, as you would, if you love them as much as yourself. You should want for them what you want for yourself. You should be willing to help them achieve the kind of things you would want to achieve. That's what it means. Now, let's take that principle then and say, if that is the case, what is it then that is most important to me? If I must love my neighbor as myself, what is it most important to me? Kedoshim Tiyu. I want to feel that I'm making a contribution. Everybody wants to feel that. Everybody, the things that people do, they do in order to make a contribution. They want to feel they're having some kind of impact. And therefore we can say that the Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha means, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, means you shall communicate to other people the value of the contribution they are making. That's what's most. If you really want to do for them what you want most for yourself, people crave most of all to feel good about themselves. That's what we saw last week, and both on the Saturday Star and on the Motzei Shabbos Shir Lahavdil, that the people want to feel good. They want to feel there is a potential for making a contribution, that they can make a contribution, that they are making a contribution, that there's something they can do about things. They don't just have to accept things, that people can make a change, that people can make a difference, and they want to feel that difference. And v'ahavta l'reacha kamecha then means it is important that you communicate to people the difference that they're making, because that's what you want most of all. And what you hate most of all is when people communicate to you that you're irrelevant, when people communicate to you that you're unimportant, that you're not making a difference, that you're incompetent, that you don't have the potential, that your contribution is not valued. That's what is most insulting, that's what's most humiliating. And v'ahavta l'reacha kamecha means the opposite of that. Don't do to others what you wouldn't want done to yourself, not only in terms of physical actions. Don't steal from people, don't lie to people, don't cheat people. There are all sorts of other mitzvahs that cover that, those areas. This is something all-encompassing, and it's more an emotional area too. If you want to express love, the way you express love is to convince, to communicate to the other person the extent to which you value what they're doing. But the Torah adds there is a limitation to that, and that is kamoicha. You shall love another person as much as you love yourself. What does self-love depend on? What makes a person love themselves? Now, there are different kinds of loving oneself. Tom Wolfe called the 1970s, I think it was, might have been the 1970s, the me generation, was that right? Was it the 70s? The generation of narcissism, when people were really involved in themselves and in the accumulation of wealth. If it was the 1970s, it certainly continued into the 1980s. The me generation, a generation of people in the Western world who were obsessed with one thing only, and that was me. The 1990s, they're talking about a different generation. So far it's only been talk, but still they're talking. And the talk is, this is now a generation of people who are willing not to work so hard and not to earn so much in order to have the finer things in life. Family life has become more important, leisure time has become more important, holidays have become more important. There's a different kind of an atmosphere that this whole environmental thing has become important, that there's a desire to become involved in a different kind of lifestyle. But we need to understand that's still me generation. It's still the same thing. It's just a shift in how I see the vehicle to self-gratification. Whereas in the 1970s and 80s, the road to self-gratification was the accumulation of wealth. In the 1990s, the road to self-gratification is leisure and pleasure. It's the softer things, maybe the more spiritual things, but they're still being pursued as vehicles to self-fulfillment, to self-gratification. People are not yet saying they want to serve the community. That they're not yet onto. And I mentioned the psychologist who wrote passages, and what she in trying to examine what it is that makes successful people. She really defines it that the key of these successful people who manage life successfully, are people who have a certain cheer about them, certain cheerfulness about them, people who have a certain optimism about them, people who have a certain sense of vision about them, people who have an enthusiasm about them. Those are the people who cope okay. And the long faces and the miseries and the South African Jewish community type, they're the one who make a mess wherever they are. They're always everything. How are you? Oi. They're always problems, never coping with change. So when change comes, as we discussed last week, they've got to run somewhere where they think it's not changing. And she analyzes in a most remarkable study what are the ingredients of the people who manage to remain cheerful, optimistic, enthusiastic, the people who are able to communicate enthusiasm, the people who are able to cheer others up, the people who are able to direct, to lead, to manage, to cope with change in their own personal lives. And she finds three yesodis, that's all. And she did vast research. The first one is, she says, it needs to be a person who's come through a change in their lives successfully, a major change of job or immigration or marriage or divorce, some major change they've coped with, come out, and come out on top. That's number one. Number two, it has to be somebody who in the process didn't cause too much damage. Another requirement, that they were sensitive to other people as they went through those changes. People who realized what drove me 10 years ago is no longer what drives me today. My ambitions of 10 years ago are no longer my ambitions today. I'm into bigger things. And they make the move into bigger things without destroying too many other people in the process. That's the second yesod. And the third yesod is that they have a purpose in their lives much greater than themselves. They're working for something much bigger than themselves. Those are the three conditions. And those are the conditions for cheerfulness. And last week we were talking about how to cope with change and the need to be able to have vision, the need to be able to see ahead, and the need to be able to keep a sense of balance and a sense of optimism which doesn't detract from a sense of realism. Optimism is not the opposite of realism. Optimism is the color of the glass through which you look at the world. You look at the world and you can see the world as overcast, and you can see the world as sunny. It's the same world. You're analyzing it scientifically, it's the same world. You see the same facts. But when it's a sunny day outside, you look at it cheerfully, and when it's an overcast day outside, you look at it miserably. And how you look at the world is dependent on you. And she finds that there are certain people, the people who cope well with change and really make impacts in their lives, are the people who are able to retain that sense of cheerfulness. But to do that, there needs to be a sense of kedusha. To do this, there needs to be a sense of dedication to a higher purpose. That everything I'm doing is for the benefit of some bigger vision than me, for something more important than me, for something broader than me, for something greater than me. And everybody wants to feel that. So the Ohavta L'Reacha Kamoicha means doing that, making other people feel the value of their contribution. But in order to do that, you need to have pride within yourself, you need to love yourself. And perhaps if I were to take Shihai's three yesodas and reduce them to one, I would say the common denominator of all these people that she's discovered who cope well with change and who make an impact are people who love themselves, are people who have pride in themselves and a sense of high self-esteem. Not arrogance, not ego. We don't have time to go into a detailed analysis of the difference between ego and self-esteem, but there's an enormous difference. High self-esteem and pride means I believe that the contribution I'm making is worth more than what I'm consuming. What I'm giving out is worth more than what I'm taking in. That's the source of pride. And if a person honestly believes that, he's able to be proud. If he believes that he's taking more than he's giving in any situation, family, social, community, business, if he feels he's taking more than he's giving, he's not able to really feel proud within himself. In the ladies' shiur this morning, we had the beautiful example of Ruth, who comes with her mother-in-law Naomi back to Israel after living in Moab, and they're destitute. They haven't got a penny. They've got nothing to eat. There are no menfolk. All the husbands have died. So Naomi's husband, Ruth's husband have died. They have no children. Just the two ladies on their own come to Israel with not a penny. Just imagine a situation like that today. A mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law emigrating to Israel or to any other country without a penny. Nothing. Can't even buy a falafel. Nothing. And she goes to collect leket and shikho in the fields. There are certain things that the poor people are entitled to. So she goes into the fields to collect charity. What kind of charity? She collects the leftovers, whatever bits of corn and produce the harvesters drop as they go, she picks up. What happens to her self-esteem and her pride? How can one live that way? Where she comes, and it says there that one particular day, Boaz, who's the owner of the field, realizes who she is and what's going on, and says to his workers, forget a little bit more than you usually do today. Drop a little bit more than you usually do today, and let her pick it up. Don't worry about it. It's okay. So she earns a lot that day. She does very well. And the Tanakh tells us, the Megillah tells us, she worked ad ha'orev until the evening. Why did she carry on working until the evening if she was doing so well? If I'm on a job, I understand why I have to work until the evening, because that's what I'm paid to do. I'm making a contribution, and I don't have a right to cut my contribution off before the day is over. But if I'm not making a contribution, if I'm only taking, surely when I've got enough, I've got to stop taking. The example I gave is a person's collecting money for himself, standing on the street with a sign, no work, no job, no anything, please give me money. And he's collecting, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he's got enough to buy a Mercedes-Benz already. Is he entitled to carry on working in the afternoon, to carry on collecting? No, you've got what you're no longer a poor person. Go home now. Find yourself work, and if you can't, come back again tomorrow. What right has she got to carry on collecting in the field when she's already collected enough? It must be because she believes she's doing a job of work. She must believe within herself that she's making a contribution. And that's how she retains her pride. And later on we see it happening. She comes home and her mother-in-law sees she's come home with more than would be expected. And she says, who is the man who helped you today? Obviously you've been helped. You've come home with much more than one could get just by picking up that which has been forgotten and that which has been dropped. Who is the man? And she answers in a peculiar way, and Chazal goes to town on it. She says, you want to know the name of the man that I worked for today? His name was Boaz. So Chazal chutzpah, you worked for him. What exactly did you do for him? Did you help him? What were you doing for him? Answers Chazal, plenty. I gave him the opportunity of giving tzedakah to some very special people. That's how she keeps her self-esteem intact. That's not how she spoke to Boaz. When she spoke to the owner of the field, she said, I don't know why you're doing this to me. I'm just a Moabite woman. How come I deserve it? I feel so overwhelmed. She talks incredibly humbly when she speaks to Boaz. But when she goes home, she's got to go home with her self-esteem intact. And she realizes that she has performed a function too. She also, if God wanted her to have food, He would find other ways to give her food. That's not what God wanted. God wanted Boaz to be the channel of that food. God wanted charity to be done. And she was the conduit of that charity. She enabled Boaz to do an act of charity, so she did make a contribution. And that's the way she comes home feeling. That even the beggar has to feel his self-esteem intact. And the way he feels his self-esteem intact is, thank you very much for the money. I'm very happy that you've given it to me. I'm very flattered that you chose to give it to me. You didn't have to give it to me. You could have given it to somebody else. But then he says to himself, quite secretly, I feel satisfied today. I got him to do a good mitzvah. He'll go to heaven for that. He'll get Olam Haba. I just got some coins. He gets Olam Haba. And thanks to who? Thanks to me. And he walks out with his head high. That's how he thinks to himself. That's the importance the Torah places on self-esteem. That even the beggar has to be aware of the contribution he's making. Because nobody's entitled to go through life believing he's a taker and not a giver. And that his taking exceeds his givings. Everybody has to be able to feel utterly confident that they're giving more than they're taking. Because only if you feel confident that you're giving more than you're taking can you love yourself. There's nothing to love if you're taking. You're a parasite. The only time you can love yourself, truly love yourself, is if you're satisfied that your contributions exceed your takings. And that's why only if you love yourself, if you believe that you're a contributor, can you be generous about complimenting other people's contributions. If you don't believe you're making a contribution, it's very hard to tell somebody else, what you did was wonderful. The contribution you've made is incredible. Very hard for a human being to do that. Almost impossible. The only time a person can be generous with his own compliments is when he feels that he doesn't need them, when he feels quite satisfied within himself that he loves himself, the other person is no threat to him, that he feels totally secure, that he feels needed. The person feels needed. It's very interesting. Somebody said to me the other day that they were taught as a child not to compliment somebody, not to ever compliment somebody else. Their mother taught them not to compliment other people. Why? Because you're giving the other person power. You're making him stronger than you. Don't do that. What is that? The desire not to give compliments. The desire not to give a compliment is exactly that. If I give you a compliment, then I'm making myself into nothing. And people, that's why people don't compliment very easily. And when they do compliment, it's very superficial. It's very mechanical. It doesn't mean anything. It's very seldom that you hear somebody complimenting another person in a way that really means, I value what you've done. You've done something so wonderful. It's so important. It's such a contribution. Very seldom. Because people can't bring themselves to uplift others. Because they don't feel uplifted enough themselves. There's no kamoicha. You can only love somebody else if you love yourself. You can only compliment somebody else if you feel complimented yourself. You can only value somebody else's contribution if you feel secure that your contribution is great too. Then you can value other people. That's the V'ahavta l'reacha kamecha. So that unless one gets to the level of kedoshim tiyu, unless one gets to the level of being holy, that means making contributions in everything that we do at all times that we're doing. To make sure that we're working for a vision that is bigger than ourselves. Only if we're doing that, so that we can have within ourselves that kind of confidence and security that I know I'm making a contribution, will we find ourselves being able to love other people in the way of making them feel that their contribution is valuable too. I've said many times in the last few weeks, and I'll say it again and again, that in many ways I believe that we're living in the most difficult time that has ever been. Yes, we're living in material comfort. Yes, we're all more or less okay. I'm not talking about South Africa. I'm talking about the whole world. And yes, there have been times in history where we've had to live under terribly adverse circumstances. In fact, there's never been a time in certainly in recent history, that Jews have been able to live in such comfort and in such peace as they're able to live today. Never been such a case. There have been very few countries in the world ever where Jews have been able to live as they're living in South Africa now. Never mind 10 or 20 years ago. Even as Jews are living in South Africa now, it's a freak of history. It's never been before. Very seldom has it been before that Jews have been able to live with this kind of comfort. And yet we're living in a time that is most difficult, that is most hard to handle. And that is because, as I explained previously, as Chazal say and Rabbeinu Yonah brings it, the biggest suffering, the most painful suffering that a human being can experience is not physical pain and discomfort, but is the pain of humiliation. And humiliation means not being valued. Humiliation means feeling that your contribution has no worth. And there has never been a time where people are more made to feel that their contribution has no worth. There are many reasons for that. One reason is liberalism. liberalism tends to want to bring everybody down to the lowest common denominator. That's the only way you can get equality between people. If you want people to be equal, the only way to do it is bring everybody down to the level of the lowest person, then everybody's equal. The moment you're going to uplift people above the level of the lowest person, there's going to be at least one person who's not equal. And so liberalism brings human beings down to the lowest possible level. And the lowest level of being is not contributing. The lowest level of being is consuming. And our whole economic philosophy is consumer driven, based on that consumption is the essence of everything. So we're living in an environment that values us as consumers. That's very belittling, to be valued as a consumer. That's like we value a cow. It's like we value a chicken. That's not even, because they at least give milk and eggs. To be valued as a consumer, you're important because you're the customer. We like to hear that because at least it's a compliment. But what are we really saying? You're important because you eat my goods and pay for them. That's why you're important. You're important because you serve my needs. That's what that phrase means. And the Western world has become very excited with this new catchword. Customer service. Customer comes first. Put the customer first. For the first time we're putting people up. What does it mean? Does that really mean putting the customer first? It doesn't mean that at all. It means you're only important because you serve me. I'm dependent on you, the customer. That's all that it may be. That's all that it is. Not you're important because you're a contributor. Not you're important because you're a producer. And we don't tend to value people for the things they give. On the contrary, when somebody comes out with something new, there's a tinge of jealousy. There's a tinge of resentment. We get antagonistic towards it. Why? Because there's a little bit of jealousy. We feel insecure ourselves. We don't take pleasure in people's contributions. And certainly if they're competing in the same field as we are, we don't take pleasure in their contributions, because we feel incapable of doing the same. And it's a vicious circle. That's the way we communicate with each other. That's the way we speak to each other. That's the way we treat each other. Always as consumers, if anything. If there's any kind of importance given to us, it's as consumers, not as producers. We don't realize that a human being has to be valued because of his capacity to be creative, because of his capacity to produce. And that when we're complimenting people, we have to compliment them for what they have produced, for what they have created. And everybody can create and everybody can produce. And so the vicious circle is set up. It becomes a spiral of doom and depression and misery and smallness and meanness and pettiness and aggressiveness and destructiveness. And it will destroy us completely. It will destroy our entire society unless we reverse it. And reversing it is starting off with Kadoshim Tiyu. Your most important function is to shift your life from one that serves your own needs to one that's serving the greater need. And through that you'll have great fulfillment. Through that you'll have great pleasure, as Shi'i says. Those are the only people who have pleasure. Those are the only people who are smiling. Those are the only people who have a glint in their eyes. Those are the only people who are walking high. Those are the only people who have pride and self-esteem. The people who feel that they're making a contribution to something much bigger than themselves. And once we get to that point and we have that self-esteem and that pride of loving ourselves, then we're able to reach the levels of being able to be va'ahavta l'reacha kamecha. Then we'll be able to relate to one another on that same level of telling people in a way that means something how much we value what they're doing too, how important it is, and to make people feel that importance and to make people feel the contribution that they're giving. Then we will become Yisrael. Then we will be not only Jews, but we will be Yisraeli, followers of Yaakov. Then we will be the people about whom the angels have been saying all this time, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael. God, you are so fortunate, you are so blessed, because you are the God of this people, Yisrael. And they're also selling themselves, they're also communicating. Anybody who's in communication, anybody who speaks in a way that somebody else can understand them, which is not that many people nowadays, but anybody who speaks in a way that somebody else can understand them is in business. He's communicating, he's selling an idea, he's selling himself, he's selling an object. There's some kind of business relationship taking place. And what I want to do in this at the Shabbaton is show Jewish people what the non-Jews are getting so excited about. And as I said to another group a week or two ago, although the work that I'm doing in the Institute of Business Ethics is done very quietly and not many people really know what's going on, in my opinion, even though I'm an interested party, it's probably one of the most exciting things that has ever happened in the Jewish community in South Africa, and probably in many other places as well, where you have large non-Jewish companies, waspish companies, who employ blacks and coloureds and Indians and right-wing Afrikaners and everybody except Jews, coming to a rabbi to ask him how Al Pi Torah they should be running their business. Now you tell me if Mashiach's not coming. But that's what's happening. These are people who are understanding that the management system that I'm promoting has its origins in the Torah. I haven't learnt it anywhere else. I haven't been to business school and I haven't studied psychology. So my only source is Chazal, and they know that and they're aware of that, and that's fine with them, and that they're finding that the impact that it's having on the performance of their companies is enormous, is unbelievable, and they're talking about it already. But this is, oh yeah, there's this rabbi and he's got the system on the Old Testament and he changes your business with it. And it's interesting that the Jews keep quite far away from it. For whatever reason, I don't know, but I think it's important the Jewish people begin to understand where these ideas come from and begin to understand their sources and their origins in the Torah. And that's really what I want to do with the Shabbaton, to take people who don't necessarily go to the usual Shabbaton. So those people, in terms of last week and the week before, for the Chochot kind of people, without being embarrassing to them, they just go and do the normal sort of things. But the people who want to get up a little bit and look with vision and just see, open up a little bit, that's what the Shabbaton is designed for. People who want to look inward, I must warn you, it's going to be beyond you. People who want to look outward, people who want to look at the universe in terms of the Torah, it'll be exciting and dynamic. And we've only been able to take one specific area to deal with, and the title of the Shabbaton is going to be South Africa's Cultural Diversity, a reason to stay or to go. Okay, we're going to analyze what it means. South Africa is a very unique society, a very unique country, and the fundamental issue of its uniqueness is its diversity. It is constituted of many, not just many different nations, but many different cultures, and they all have different ways of looking at things, and they all have different ambitions, and they all have different value systems, and this is all now trying to come together in a new country. Up until now, there was an autocratic imposition of a value system from a particular government that said, this is the way things are, this is the way things shall be, and that's it. And it worked in a certain funny way for a certain funny period of time. But it's not working anymore, and we're now saying, let's see if we can make one country without the autocratic imposition of one group's value systems. So what are the value systems going to be? How are we going to overcome this? How are we going to find this? This is what the Torah should be used for. And as I've said over and over again, not that Kashrus isn't important, it's vitally important, and Shabbos is vitally important, and Yom Tov is vitally important, and the laws of family purity are vitally important. All of that is vital. But that's not where the Torah stops, that's where it starts. And when a country is searching how are you going to handle cultural diversity of the type that we've got in South Africa and formulate it into a new nation, there's no better place to look in than the Torah. Just as any other major issue that faces humanity, there's no better place to look into it than the Torah. And it's about time we started realizing that the Torah has this fund of knowledge, that the Torah has this ability to address current issues in the most amazing ways that nobody else has ever thought of. That's when we've got it right here. But we still carry on checking for bugs as if that's all the Torah is about. Very important to check for bugs, but that's not all the Torah is about. It goes much wider and much bigger than that. So that really is going to be the subject of the Shabbaton. And the Shabbos part of it, obviously, we'll be dealing with the Torah sources for the ideas. On Motzei Shabbos and Sunday, we'll be applying them into business and domestic areas, into some kind of understanding of how to handle cultural diversity. In your own home, you've got probably a minimum of 2, possibly 3 or 4 cultures operating. That means the average housewife is managing 4 cultures very often. Her own families, sometimes 2 domestics, and a gardener, who might all be from different backgrounds. You might have a Khoza and a Zulu and a Tswana, and a family of Jews, all working together in a home. How much do you know and understand about them? How is she managing them? It's an area that we've never looked at, we've never bothered to look at before. But it's an area we have to start looking at, and there's no better place in understanding how cultures operate than the Torah itself. And that's really going to be the impact of that, of this particular Shabbaton. It will probably be booked out very early because we're starting to advertise it this week, so that if anybody is interested, please make sure that as soon as possible you let the organizers know and have your names put down, so that they can make the necessary arrangements.